Hello, and welcome to the 1840 podcast, where each month we explore a different topic balancing modern sensibilities with traditional sensitivities to give you new approaches to timeless Jewish ideas. I'm your host, David Beshefkin. And this month, we're exploring science and religion. This podcast is part of a larger exploration of those big, juicy, controversial topics that come up when Jewish life, religious life, bumps up into the modern world. So be sure to check out 1840.org, that's 1840.org, where you can find videos, articles, and recommended readings. So a question I get a lot is, how do you choose your guests? How do you choose, like, who to talk about a specific subject? And I think, as opposed to many other podcasts, we actually have an easier time choosing our guests because our podcast isn't just about interesting people or, dare I say, meaningful people or smart people or funny people. We try to, each month, we pick a topic and we want to do a deep dive in this topic and have different people from different angles be able to talk about it. So right away, there's kind of a very easy system that, you know, we have a topic at hand and we need to find people to speak about it. But once you kind of have your topic, whether it's comedy or Talmud or Jewish peoplehood, then it gets tricky. Like, how do you find the experts on any one of these given topics? And the reason why I'm introducing our guest today with this question is because I definitely hesitated to have Rabbi Dr. Meir Tribbetz on. I pursued him for a very, very long time. He's not as well known as some of our other guests in America, but he really has an incredibly fascinating take. And this really gets into how I choose my guests. I think sometimes you choose a guest because their approach, their clarity, their just the way that they give things over is so clear, so moving. Maybe it's their personal story that you know that they're going to shed light and a perspective on the topic at hand that nobody else could do. I don't think that's what was at the front of my mind with Rabbi Dr. Meir Tribbetz. I think there was something else with Rabbi Tribbetz. And that is, I think that there is a value sometimes in just knowing that certain people are out there. And Rabbi Tribbetz is one of those people. I'm going to be honest right from the get-go, and that is that Rabbi Tribbetz's style and speaking, it's fairly complex. He gets like all the way in deep on a certain subject, and his thought is kind of iterative and a little bit hard to follow at times. That's no, God forbid, criticism on Rabbi Tribbetz. He's not a professional podcaster. He's a Rosh Yeshiva teacher and educator, and I'll tell you more about him in a second. But I think his mastery and almost his willingness to ask and confront some of the most radical questions related to religion, Torah, Judaism, and the modern world, knowing that a mind and a person like that is out there, I think in and of itself serves a very important purpose of sorts. There are a lot of other places where you can find his recordings. They're not so easy to find, but if you Google Rabbi Meir Tribbetz, you'll find a great deal of stuff on TorahDownloads.com, on Tosefta Online. He has a lot of really amazing stuff. He doesn't write a great deal, but the topics that interest him has always fascinated me. And it's really at the heart of why I really went after him. I sent a ton of emails. He's so busy, lives in Eretz Yisrael and Israel, and was a little bit hard to pin down. But he was so gracious and so kind to spend time talking about this. I think the wow of Rabbi Tribbetz is to look at the topics that he confronts, and we're going to have links to, hopefully, as many of his writings as possible. But Rabbi Tribbetz has always been interested in the canonization of the Talmud. How did the Talmud come together? What is the Talmud itself? And he's given not one, not two, but like dozens, maybe 20, 30, 40, 40-part series on these big questions, like, How was the seminal act of bringing together all of Jewish thought, ideas, practice, law, which is the Talmud in one place, how was that done? And what does it represent? And I think in many ways, understanding the Talmud and what the Talmud is trying to accomplish is a window to understanding why very often the Talmud seems to represent scientific views that do not cohere with modern science. It's a question on what was being canonized, what was being done, and why was it being done? And that's really at the heart of our conversation. And so whether or not you're able to follow or have extra time to look up some of the sources, all of which hopefully we're going to link to on 1840.org, so please check it out. Whether or not you're able to follow, knowing that Rabbi Tribbetz is out there, seeing the questions that he is willing to confront is really a purpose in and of itself. So just a little bit about Rabbi Tribbetz. Rabbi Tribbetz teaches in a yeshiva known as Machon Shlomo, which is a yeshiva for like Ivy League grads who weren't afforded a Jewish education in the way, you know, that many other people go to yeshivas in high school and elementary school. And this is taking people who didn't get that opportunity, are clearly superbly bright. I've always been enamored with the work that Machon Shlomo has done. And Rabbi Tribbetz is a Rebbe at Machon Shlomo, as well as teaching philosophy, halacha, and chumash. He graduated with an undergraduate degree in physics from Princeton and a PhD from Stanford. So this is someone who has been deeply immersed in both the secular scientific world and the world of Torah. He is an astounding contributor to Torah. And either one of his contributions in either of these fields could have taken your average man a lifetime. And the fact that he has masteries in both of these really is a testament to his brilliance. Rabbi Tribbetz has also taught for Tikva and the HashkafaCircle.com. He's done really such amazing work, which is why I'm so excited to share this conversation, but more so to share the personality and who he is. He didn't want to talk about himself at all. Maybe we'll have snippets of that in the beginning. He wanted to stick to the questions at hand. He didn't want to get into his upbringing and his life and all that other really fascinating stuff. And maybe we can convince him another time to come back to talk more about that, because there's so many more questions I could have asked Rabbi Tribbetz. But Rabbi Tribbetz, more than even the conversation that we had, which I thought was absolutely remarkable, his idea, his brilliance, and his mastery are something that all of our listeners should be familiar with. He has contributed and really elucidated some of the most complex questions related to Jewish thought and modern ideas and how they cohere and adapt with one another. So it is my absolute pleasure to introduce my conversation with Rabbi Meir Tribbetz. So welcome, everyone, to the 1840 podcast. It is a distinct privilege and pleasure to welcome Harav Meir Tribbetz, who is a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivas Machon Shlomo, who teaches many, many yeshivas in Eretz Yisroel. He is a prolific writer and speaker. He has a PhD from Stanford University in physics and really has an unbelievable story and trajectory of both a deep secular knowledge of understanding science and ideas, and an even richer current responsibilities and job, so to speak, teaching Torah and the uniqueness of Torah to a new generation of Jews. Rabbi Tribbetz, it is really an honor, privilege, and pleasure to speak with you today.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So we're not going to get into all of the details of your upbringing. Can you at least tell us what was the focus of your studies at Stanford?
I was interested. You're right. I was interested in mathematics and the science and theoretical, you know, how should I say it? I was interested, you know, in the focus was really mathematics, but in theoretical mathematics has applications in science, etc. In physics. That was my focus.
Okay. So I want to jump right in, and I want to begin with an extraordinarily famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, "Hafuchba v'hafuchba dekulaba." turn it over and turn it over. It is all there, referring to the wisdom contained in the Torah. And as we explore the idea of science and Torah, I was wondering if you could begin by kind of explaining, what does that mean? Does that mean all of science, all of contemporary physics and mathematics are contained if you learn enough Chumash, enough Torah, enough Talmud, enough Gemara, you could become a nuclear physicist, you could become a doctor? What does that mean, that if you turn it over enough, it is all there?
Look, it in other words, I mean, there's a machlekes of a mafarshim. I understand that Mishnah, but I think that anyone who's going to use the Torah, right, of Chazal, and certainly, you know, the Chumash, at arriving in a certain type of a scientific discovery, I think is really mistaken, and actually is very, very dangerous. It is true that the Torah, which is min hashamayim, so on the underlying basis, right?
From heaven. I'm sorry if I interlude with some brief translations.
Right. At the end of Mishpatim, so the Torah speaks about that Moshe Rabbeinu came and to give the Torah to Klal Yisrael, right?
The Jewish people, yes.
Jewish people. And the Jewish people had a tremendous vision. The Torah describes their tremendous vision they had, kiviyachol, right, of a tremendous metaphysical vision. And then it says, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right, as not to upset the joy of that day, right, decided there were certain people who looked at it belave gas, meaning that they were eating and drinking, right, and they didn't take it, I guess, with the appropriate seriousness that it required. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu, right, Aleh Alei Ahara, right,
come up on the mountain.
Mountain, right? And I will give you and the Pasuk says, Edlech Saluchais, Atev HaMitzvah Asher Kasavti Elohi Reisam. I will give you the Torah. Now, in Gemara Daf Heyam and Aleph, in Brachais, the Gemara there says that what is this Pasuk referring to? So the Gemara says that it's referring to the Luchais HaEvan, which is the two tablets, right? It's referring to the Mishnah. It's referring to the Neviim and Ksuvim, and it's referring to the Gemara.
It's all there.
However, what's interesting is what happened. In other words, at first they had this incredible medical vision, metaphysical vision, right? And then after that, somehow the Chazal tell us that the Skenim, the elder people, somehow they didn't take the right approach. They looked at it belave gas. There was a certain arrogance. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu, right, I'm going to give you Mishnah and Gemara. So you can look at the Meshech Chochmah there. He explains the Pasuk, Ater Asher Kasavti. So we have to say that there's a Torah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Torah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu roots the Torah in the truth of the physical world. That's the root of the Torah. But man, right, is not privy to that truth. Man has to learn the Torah, the Mishnah, the Gemara, in other words, in the way in which the Torah should be alpeh, right?
As the oral law.
The oral law, the way with the oral law, we have the oral law as a tradition, which means that, in other words, even though the Gemara says, for example, the Gemara says in Kuf on the days, in Erevin, that the Torah was not given, we can learn ethics, you know, from the animals, right? From mm-hmm. the cat. Right? But nonetheless, so that's the Meshech Chochmah intimates, that's called the Torah Shekasabdi. That's a Kodesh Baruch Hu's Torah. But ultimately, science is a human activity. Man is supposed to learn the oral law, right, in terms of the Messiah, the tradition that we have from the sages. And man should not think that the Gemara, the sages, are privy to this ultimate scientific truth, which certainly is at the basis of the Torah, but this is not man's role. This is what man does. So in my opinion, is science, according to the Torah, science is very much a human activity. The Torah, right, Chazal, right, the tradition of Chazal, are communicating in the Devar Hashem, and the Chidushim of the oral law, the knowledge of the oral law, but Chazal was speaking in terms of the science of their day. Right, and this is explained by the Chazon Ish. He speaks about this when he speaks about the laws of treifas, right? Animals which which are rendered forbidden to be eaten because they're missing things in which they won't be able to live very much longer, that Chazal, in fact, actually decided halachic issues are based upon their science. And we shouldn't think that Chazal were privy to all the advances of science that we have today. That's a very, very important thing. Yeah.
So if I understand you correctly, there's this notion that there's like this supernal transcendent Torah that we don't necessarily have access to when we open up to interpret the Mishnah or the Gemara. And maybe was the Torah that reflects all of the truths of the world. But the Torah that we have in front of us is much more almost narrow in its focus of what it's coming to resolve.
Right. And that's why it's very, very important. So, for example, there's an interesting, we can go on for a long time about this. If you look in the tshuvas, the response of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a give and take, a masa matin with the Chazei Nish. And they're speaking about electricity. So the Chazei Nish, as we all know, was of the opinion that if a person puts on an electrical item, right? So there's a prohibition from the Torah, which is called binyan, which is called...
On Shabbos, right?
Speaking about on Shabbos. So Shlomo Zalman, right, says to me, doesn't understand. You know, he says, based upon what the physicists tell us about electricity, that a person, I guess, you know, he puts on the switch and there's 12 electrons. So he says, what's the difference between putting on a switch in Shabbos, like putting on a fan, and turning on a faucet, that the water goes through the faucet?
Mm-hmm.
Kazanish gives him a very interesting answer. And he says, but don't you understand that the instrument is going to be mislachayim, from death to life? It's like it's coming alive. So what I understand for that Masa Matan of Shlomo Zalman is the following thing. It might be that in modern physics, if I ask you to describe electricity, you would speak about the flow of electrons. The question is, if you turned on a fan in front of Rav Ashi and Ravina, what would he say? Ravina Rav Ashi didn't know quantum physics. Ravina Rav Ashi would say an incredible thing. You have metal here, and now the metal comes alive. So the Chazon Ish was telling Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, we can't judge or try to understand Chazal in terms of modern science. If you want to understand the Das Torah, right, the opinion, the legal opinion of Chazal on different issues, we have to place ourselves in the position of Chazal, and what would Chazal say about this thing? That's what the Chazon Ish was saying to Shlomo Zalman.
Fascinating. We have to both basically superimpose the conceptual world of the Gemara onto modern day phenomena to assess its implications.
So I always claim that I think that Rav Shlomo Zalman, right, was actually agreed to the Chazon Ish eventually. There's a very interesting, I don't know if it's a tshuva, but Rav Shlomo Zalman writes about the elevator. Can a person go in an elevator on Shabbos? Right, let's be an elevator is working by, let's say it's working by a Shabbos clock, but it's not what's called a Shabbos elevator, but when the elevator goes down, the motor is working harder. So Shlomo Zalman says it's permitted. Why is it permitted? Because even though it could possibly be that if you look into the mechanical motion of the motor is actually exerting much more energy, but I see the elevator going at the same speed. In other words, from the human point of view, it doesn't seem like I'm doing anything to the elevator. If I go into the engineering of the elevator, I'm going to see obvious changes. But on the other hand, right, as far as I can see, the elevator is actually moving at the same speed all the time because of that, Rav Shlomo Zalman held, and I know this actually from someone who spoke to him, that you don't really need what's called a Shabbos elevator, which regulates the motor, but actually you can have an elevator going on a Shabbos clock, and that's good enough. It's a very interesting that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach also followed, I'm just going a little bit further, followed this this understanding of the Chazon Ish with the refrigerator, opening up a refrigerator. He has a long tshuva on the refrigerator.
On Shabbos. I just don't want any listeners to think you can't open up a refrigerator in the week.
But then Rav Shlomo Zalman wants to say that the Kubba has to be the one opening the refrigerator, all these intricate electronic things are happening, but that's not why I'm opening up the refrigerator. I'm on the refrigerator to get my food. In other words, these things are happening, but they don't enter into the Melechus Basheva, the intentionality, right? That in other words, that's the vital halachic factor whether opening the refrigerator is prohibited or not prohibited. So therefore, we have this same concept. In other words, and this is something, I mean, not everybody actually goes like this, but we have seen that when we look at a question, this seems to be Chazanish, when we look at the question is, how would Chazal look at this?
Which now, can you explain, because it's such a fascinating concept that you're saying conceptually, when we assess halachic Jewish legal questions, we're not trying to get to the root and the lens of science. We're not even trying to get through a contemporary understanding. We're trying to superimpose a understanding from nearly, I mean, over 1,000 years ago. Why conceptually are we frozen in time when we assess Jewish legal questions?
Yeah, okay, so there's two reasons. First of all, I mean, in traditional Judaism, our authority is Chazal.
Chazal means what?
The Chazal, I mean, that's called the Gemara, the Amorayim.
Okay.
I'm not coming to interpret Chazal, but we're speaking about the Amorayim. In other words, Judaism understands that halachic authority ultimately is in Chazal, right? There's a in the Gemara in Lamed Gimel and Aleph in Sanhedrin, there's a machlekes between the Baal HaMa'or and the Rosh, right?
A dispute,
can the Rishayim and the medieval commentators actually argue on the Goyim and go back to the Gemara? But actually, the Rosh rules at the end that the final authority is the Gemara. In other words, the final authority is the Gemara. A Rishon, the medieval commentary, can argue on, let's call the period of commentators from, let's call it from the 6th century to the 10th century, right? They're called the Goyim, right? Because you can bring a guy from the Shas. In other words, ultimately, the source of authority is the Shas. So if the source of authority is the Shas, right? We can't impose knowledge that the Amoraim didn't have. But rather, in fact, the Das Torah that's involved in deciding a halachic issue is, how would Chazal look at this? And that's the important thing. I think a lot of people miss this today, but I think that's really, and that's why learning Gemara still becomes the paramount and central basis, right, of all halacha. And that's what that's going to say. Yeah.
Now, could you explain a little bit, and I'm going to follow up with some of my own difficulties related to the science that's characterized in the Gemara, but could you just speak a little bit more? Where does that authority derive from? It was sealed. I didn't sign off on that. Why is it that there is this very sharp division between what is written in the Gemara and even the evolution of the Gemara? It's so vague when it was actually canonized. Why is that such a seminal break in Jewish history? Where does that authority derive from that none of, nobody here, even if you're a big genius, a very holy person, you can't dispute what has been canonized in the Gemara?
Okay, so
and I'm sorry to ask such a massive question.
No, you're asking, actually, there's two questions. I think you're really asking really two questions. The first question you're asking is, why is the Gemara an authority?
Yes.
Right. Okay. This is something which is actually discussed. There's a very famous give and take between the Chazanish, everything of Elchanan Wasserman, Hashemikam. I mean, with Amasa Matin, why, in fact, actually, what made the Gemara special that we can't argue on the Gemara, right? Elchanan Wasserman seems to suggest that somehow there was a
consensus, like a unified gathering. Consensus,
right? And the Chazanish says something a little bit more abstract, that basically there was understanding of the Yeridus HaDeiras, right?
It's like metaphysical, like just right. Our connection to God now, and to law changed.
Right. Okay, so now I want to say like this. I'm not sure that Chazanish meant like this, but I'm going to claim that this is probably, if you would ask the Chazanish and push him, he probably would agree to what I'm saying, right?
Okay.
You can't give a reason why the Gemara was accepted. Because if you can give a reason why the Gemara was accepted, right, it can be violated. In other words, by definition, the establishment of the authority of a canon cannot have a reason. Just like, for example, right, you can't give a reason why God created the world. Because if you can give a reason why God created the world, then you're like God. Even though I know from Hashkafa, everybody asks why God created the world. But as the Leshem explains in the Arizal, right, that's only Mitzeda from our perspective. When we say God created us for a certain reason, the question is, how should we look at creation? But ultimately, on the God side, I can't say why God created the world. So I think in a much parallel way, we can't say, right, we can't ask described the process by which the God became an authority, it just became an authority. Now, how to become an authority? So it seems to be very, very clear. What happened was, is that a certain period of time, right, all the Gemara became a text, and everybody's trying to interpret the text. It was like a process. We don't know how the process, what gave root to the process, right? But nonetheless, at a certain point of time, and according to what I say, probably between the 8th and 10th centuries, already, right, we see that the majority, that the poskim, those halakhic authorities, would rule based upon their understanding of the Gemara. Once the Gemara becomes the canonical text of authority, and that all rulings are really interpretations of the Gemara, then mim'ela, in a natural way, the Gemara is established like that, and that is its source of authority. In other words, I want to claim is that, in fact, you can't give a reason why the Gemara is an authority, but it became an authority.
And since its existence, its very existence, and the way right. people related right. descriptively it became an authority. As an authority. Why was it an authority? Right. You'd have to be. So here's my question. Yeah. as it relates to that. Yeah. And I've had this has troubled me personally for a long time.
Yeah.
Very often in the Gemara, you have things that were canonized as a part of the Gemara that are clearly at not, you know, they don't seem to have contemporary applications. You have folk wisdom, how to cure an illness, bloodletting, all of these medical issues.
Yeah.
And you look at that, and again, people talk about it and say, oh, they were just giving the medicine of their time. Don't worry about right. it. But right. here's what frustrates me. If yes. the Gemara was meant, in fact, to be the canon that guides Jewish practice for centuries, and mm-hmm. so why did they canonize that? Why did they not know at the time that this was meant to be a kind of what we talk about, like in prophetic books in Tanakh? We say we canonize prophecies that are ledoros, that are for all generations. So right. why did we canonize things in the Gemara that seem to be so temporal that, you know, here's a way to cure your stomach ache, but don't try this after the 11th century because you're going to get ill from it. It almost, right. it shakes my confidence in the very deliberateness of the canonization itself.
Yeah, so I was like this. I don't think that at one point a person said, okay, we're canonizing this. The Gemara is what's called an oral tradition, right? And just like, for example, I'm speaking to you right now. So we're speaking about science and Torah, but we might speak about other things too, whatever it is.
In other words, I hope so.
The Gemara speaks about Agadatas, this and that. Agadatas might have been
the stories, sure.
Right, in other words, so what happens is there was this oral tradition that was continued for many generations. And at a certain point, it was frozen. It's not that someone actually decided, well, you know, we're going to create this canon, because if a person decided to create the canon, you could ask him, why did you create the canon? It somehow was frozen. So in other words, these are all traditions that were frozen. Once you freeze an oral tradition, so basically you're freezing all of these oral traditions, and some of the oral traditions are halachic, but some of them are not halachic, right? This is this goes back to the point I'm trying to make. It wasn't a design. It was frozen at a certain point. At a certain point, right, somehow nothing was added to the Gemara. And all these different things that the Gemara brings, whether a gadot or maybe medicines, you know, this was interested in, Chazal were interested in medicines too. And this became part of the corpus. In other words, we're not speaking about intelligent design. We're speaking about intelligent design. So therefore, you have a question. Why did I intelligently put this in and not the other thing in? But we're speaking about something that somehow happened. It was a tradition, right? That it was frozen at a certain point. So what they froze was the discussions not only regarding halacha, but agadata, but also different types of, you know, medicines that Chazal were interested in it, right?
But doesn't removing the deliberateness of the canonization kind of shake the our ability to be so interpretive, meaning the way that we approach every other halachic passage in the Talmud is with such deliberateness. We ask contradictions from here and there, and we approach the overall text as if there was an intelligent design and a deliberateness to it. So
I'll tell you yes and no. There was and no. Let me tell you, for example, if when I give a shiur in the Chon Shlomo, I ask, we learn, let's say, Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos. So I ask the boys, who is the editor of the Shas? So they'll say, Rabbi Yehuda Ashi or Rabbi Sobarai, have you ever said? I said, no, the Tosfos is also an editor of the Shas. Because what happens is when there's a contradiction between two passages of the Gemara and Tosfos comes in and really creates a Talmud, Tosfos is editing the Shas too. In other words, the editing process didn't really end at a certain point. It continued, except that the further editing would not violate the initial editing. It would add layers on top of this. So in other words, what we have to understand is that the oral law is not something which is static. It continues. Even when Paiskim write tshuvas today, Ramesha Feinstein writes tshuvas in which actually comes up with tremendous chidushim mahalacha, that's part also of the editing of the Gemara. In other words, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein Shalom is not going to argue with the Gemara, but he might come to find different ways of resolving contradiction in the Gemara, which is also a type of editing too. The purpose of the oral law is very important. The oral law is supposed to evolve. Why is there a written law and an oral law? How come a Kodesh Baruch God didn't give us just a written law? The answer is, there's a part of the law which has to remain fixed, rigid in time, because that's ultimately the authority, but there has to be a part of the law which allows it to evolve. In other words, the oral law, in a certain sense, evolves the written law. That's what it does. We don't like to, you know, evolution is a dirty word for many people, but the truth is, right, is that Chazal evolved the written law. The Rambam says in Sherish Beis, and this is the way I understand Sherish Beis in the Rambam.
In his work on the commandments.
Right, and that actually, Ein Mikra Yotzei Peshuto, the Chazanish says... That,
meaning, Ein Mikra Yotzei Mide Peshuto, meaning a verse cannot be extracted from its plain reading.
Right, which means what's happening is that the, when Chazal make a drosha, right, when they derive from a pasuk, you can't say that's the original intentional meaning. But Chazal are using the creative powers to interpret the pasuk, and by virtue of the Chazal can actually make a drasha, and it could be in the Sidiraisa. But the drasha, the halacha, was created by the human intellect. So in other words, the essence of oral law is evolution. Every person who learns a Gemara and says a chiddush in the Gemara is, in a certain sense, evolving the oral law.
So they're a part of Chazal too, in a way.
Right, so therefore it shouldn't bother you. The fact that it's not static just means is that the essence of oral law is to evolve.
And that authority to evolve, that authority to make those drushas,
was given to Chazal.
Where do you see that deriving from?
That's from Chazal, that's Leisasa. According to the Rambam, that's part of Leisasa. What part of Leisasa is that the Rambam says in the beginning of Mamrim that drushas, gezeiras, minhagim, right, takanas are all part of Leisasa. What Leisasa means is, even though the Rambam says that the
Leisasa is a verse in the Torah, meaning you shouldn't stray from the interpretive power.
Even though the drashas, the Rambam says that the Rabbana, it doesn't mean that did is the Rabbana, did is the Raisa, but it's generated by the rabbis, but the rabbis were given the authority by Kodesh Baruch Hu of Leisasa. So basically, the Chazal argue by virtue of they derive new laws from Psukim, based upon their authority to do so. And that's the authority was given to Chazal, and that's why the Torah law is actually effective and is authoritative for all generations, by virtue of the fact that the Gedolim, the great halakhic decisors in every generation, are able to evolve the law. So your question is not really a question, because in other words, you're looking at the oral law as something which is static. The oral law is in constant evolution.
And theologically, I want to come back to two questions. Why was the, you know, I could see practically, you know, there were no refrigerators back then. There were no, but theologically, why is that so central to the essence of what our Masorah, our tradition's about?
Because the Torah is eternal. the Torah is eternal. The Torah is supposed to speak to every generation. How can the Torah speak to every generation without our ability to interpret it, the authority to interpret it in every generation?
And you must get, I mean, you teach so many people who come not from Orthodox backgrounds where this is taken as a given. So how do you explain why, if there is this ability to evolve, if there is this ability to interpret, what separates kind of in the Orthodox denomination there, you know, and I'm not talking about your average young Israel rabbi, but what separates the senior rabbis within that denomination from other more liberal interpretations of the law?
I'll tell you why. If you look, there's a very, very, there's a book written, it's called The Halachic Process, I think by a Joel Roth.
Oh, sure. I know who that is.
You know that book, right? Very good. So Joel Roth, right, explains that sometimes we have to basically reject Gemaras because they're, in fact, actually, they're not relevant. You know, the halacha really is not relevant. In fact, even Joel Roth even says in one place in the book that many drushes of Chazal.
Sure. We can make our own drushes,
more than that, because our new knowledge of Semitic languages allows us to, in fact, actually to understand the verses completely. That's the difference. In other words, I evolved the oral law, but the evolution of the law always has to be an interpretation of the Talmud. The concern is, understand, I could drop the Talmud and evolve it, right? That is an interpretation. That's the difference. In other words, if you're interpreting the Talmud, I'm evolving it, but it's an interpretation. In other words, the evolution is rooted, right, in the text, right?
You're always reacting to something fixed.
Right, but if
that's the nature of interpretation.
There's a passage in the Gemara that's no longer relevant. I reject it for humanitarian or whatever ethical reasons today. That's not called an interpretation.
But I'm sorry to come back to this. And again, isn't that exactly what we're saying about the science in the Torah? Isn't that exactly that's why it troubles me. Isn't that exactly what we're saying about the passages that provide medicines in the Gemara? This is no longer relevant. That was just in there.
I would say that those Gemaras who speak about medicines, I'm going to say this is going to sound a little controversial. I'm not sure they should make Birchas HaTorah on it.
Yikes!
Right. In fact, there's a.
And you don't even consider that Torah necessarily.
It's from Chazal, but right. I don't think it's necessarily Torah. It's not binding. In fact, actually, there's a Tosefta, right? There's a Tosefta that's the Sefta. I think the Sefta is in Peah. Ain't learned them halachas ben agadas. Okay, this is an interesting thing. Why don't we learn halachas from the agadas? It's because there's different peyushim on that. There's a famous Jewel in the Yehudas, and Kuf Samach Aleph.
Sure.
But there are actually parts of the Gemara. If I don't learn halacha from it, it means that they are edifying, but it doesn't mean that they're relevant. So agadas certainly are relevant, right? But I don't learn halachas from agadas, right? Okay, this is a big, I don't want to go into this, is a big issue. There's a pre-chadas, b'maim chaim, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But clearly, even Chazal, having acknowledged the fact, parts of the Gemara which I don't learn halachas, meaning what? Meaning that, in fact, right, Chazal themselves are acknowledging that certain things might not be relevant. Might not be relevant.
So let me ask you almost like that meta question, that similar to what I asked before. When you ask yourself, you know, the Chazon Ish writes this in countless places, that there's some sense of providence in the way our canonization, the way our overall tradition worked. Do you have some theological explanation for what was the providence that allowed these, what are our, I'm deeming, you know, less relevant or quasi-relevant passages?
So let me answer your question. Very interesting. The Chazon Ish is Lashon and Treifas. I don't know if it's in front of you. He speaks about, you know, the Gemara says in Avodah Zarah that the world will be 6,000 years. It's 2,000 years Toyu, 2,000 years
Toyu meaning chaos.
Yeah. 2,000 years of what's called Torah, and 2,000 years of Yemais Beshiach, the Messianic era. Okay? And the Chazon Ish makes an interesting statement in that Hilchos Treifas, where the Chazon Ish says that the Treifas were decided by Chazal based upon their science. So the Chazon Ish makes it, the Chazon Ish says that during the 2,000 years of Yemais Beshiach, things might change. Now, It's very, very interesting. There's a Gemara in Pesachim, right? In Tzadik Vav, there's a dispute between Chochmei Yisrael, Chochmei Umas Ha'olam, right? How does this...
The wisdom of the nations versus the wisdom of the Jewish people. I'm sorry.
That's okay. How does the sun go around the world? Once again,
sure.
Right. So the Chochmei Yisrael say the sun basically goes like this on top. It makes a semicircle on top, you know, and then goes up into the sky all over, and then doesn't go underneath the earth. In other words, it basically goes on the upper hemisphere, goes into the celestial sphere, and
pops out.
Yeah, pops out again, right? And actually, this is actually the basis of the sheet of the Rabbeinu Tam.
Sure, Shmark. Yeah.
Rebbe, but Chok Musan says no, that the sun
revolves around
underneath. Says Rebbe, Chochmei Ha'umas Olam are correct. Why? Because the springs are warm at night. Which means Rebbe rules not like Chochmei Yisrael. Rebbe is at the end of the 2,000 years of Torah. The Chazanish understood at the time of Rebbe, that's when there was a bifurcation between Torah and science.
Meaning the 2,000, meaning in the six, in this archetype that we have 6,000 years, 2,000 years of chaos, 2,000 years of Torah, and then 2,000 years of Mashiach, it was Rebbe who was kind of the codifier of the Mishnah, who what did he do vis-a-vis scientific Rebbe, knowledge?
Well, I don't want to go into Rebbe in general, but we see that at this point of Rebbe, based upon what the Chazanish is saying, I'm bringing a raya from the Chazanish.
Yeah.
Rebbe is the first Tana to rule to say that there's a difference between the signs of the nations and the signs of Chochmei Yisrael, and Rebbe rules like the scientists of the nations. Meaning this bifurcation takes place at the end of the 2000 of Torah, which means that basically what I would read into the Chazanish, Chazanish doesn't say that, in fact, actually, during the 2000 years of Torah, there was a commensurability between Torah and science. At the end of this 2,000 years, right, heralded by Rebbe, statement in the Gemara in Pesachim, there's a bifurcation between Torah and science, which I understand that that's really the authority. Rebbe's Mishnah is the basis of authority of the oral law. The Gemara is a commentary on the Mishnah. So when the oral law becomes impacted and becomes and bases authority, it bases its authority at a time that already science and Torah are not necessarily commensurable. And because of that, we have to go back and try to understand what the sages say in terms of the way they looked at science and not the way we look at science.
And let me return back to that theological question about the providence of the canonization, because that's what you were getting on. Why, when you look at these passages of the Gemara that you would not even make a Berachas HaTorah on, why do you think there was, again, assuming you believe in this notion of divine providence, you've quoted the Chazon Ish a few times, who really champions this as it comes to discovery of later manuscripts and in countless other places, what is the divine providence that allowed seemingly, again, less meaningful, I'm scared to call it meaningless, statements that were canonized in this treasured text?
We don't know. We don't know what it is. I suspect that this commensurability of Torah and science bifurcated, broke down at this point. That's when this thing happened. And therefore, because of this, the canonization took place at that point. In other words, at a certain point, when the Torah was commensurable with the science of the world, then in fact, actually, that's when it was ultimately canonized, right?
So personally, you are not bothered if you see that there are scientific developments that do not cohere with Talmudic wisdom.
Not at all.
Not at all. So let me kind of, I know your time is extraordinarily valuable, and I personally could talk to you for another 10 hours. Yeah. When you are trying to introduce the Gemara and the uniqueness of what the Talmud is trying to do, especially because you're teaching students who don't have such a rich background, so I guess they could hold on tight to the roller coaster of your thought and ideas, but what is a book that you would recommend them to really appreciate this? Is there an English book that you would recommend?
Unfortunately not.
Unfortunately, you don't have anything.
Unfortunately, not. Unfortunately, to teach a person how these things work, I think there's a book that's needed. But maybe the shiurim that Naftali is giving, maybe that will come into a book.
Uh-huh.
But in fact, you're actually right. A book like this is actually needed. I don't think that really, let me tell you something. I teach in Machon Shlomo.
And that's for people who don't have a strong Jewish background.
Okay, right. But they're very, very bright. And, you know, they're
extraordinarily bright. Ivy Leagues, most of them, yeah.
I'm also a Reich Kotel. I teach, you know, I have people who've learned in Chavon, Panovich.
Sure.
Right? And they're missing just as much as the boys of Machon Shlomo. Another one. Many times when I have to teach the boys of Machon Shlomo, same things I have to teach, you know, boys, you know, Avreichim, you know, who've learned in Chavon and Panovich were
serious yeshivas.
There is the yeshivas do not the curriculum of the yeshivas, put it this way, they don't give the person a perspective of what we call the meta halacha. In other words, what are the rules of the Gemara? What's Gemara? What's Mishnah? This is something that it's needed. And someone's going to have to write a book about this. I don't know if people will introduce this into the curriculum of the yeshivas, but I think it's important. The Gedolim knew these things, but I think this is important that really people should acquire such a knowledge. How should I say it? In other words, there's a need for a book, but this is right. Most people come out of yeshivas, even the best yeshivas, right, have absolutely, you know, have no idea of how the process works.
Mm-hmm. Is there a Hebrew work that you would recommend to appreciate the meta halacha?
No, unfortunately not. Look, there might be. Look, I'm not really, you know, in touch with all of the, you know, but unfortunately not.
Uh-huh, unfortunately, okay. Now,
most of the things that we're speaking about, you have to be gleaned from different places, you know, from the different places.
It requires kind of this intuition and deep immersion in the text themselves. Maybe that's why it's never taught, because to just kind of lay it out sequentially can be really, really difficult. Just a few kind of quick concluding questions, and you know, I hope that we can speak more. If people want to find more of your thoughts and ideas, where can they find them?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think a number of my papers were put on Satav Eveyan, is Rabbi Treibitz, on the internet. If you look at Rabbi Treibitz, I think someone collected a lot of my papers.
Okay, and we'll put that link up there. We'll put that link up there.
If I could advertise, volume 27 of Chakira magazine.
Sure, the journal.
Right. So I edited quite a number of years ago lectures of Rabbi Soloveitchik.
Sure, the philosophical lectures.
Right. So actually, the first five lectures actually came out in volume number 27.
Wow. We'll put that link up there. Sure.
And actually, there's 15 lectures altogether, and they're going to be published, I think, next Chakira, then and the one after that. They're going to come out. Whatever. I don't.
This relates to that question. Maybe you've already answered it. If somebody gave you a paid sabbatical to write a work, what do you think you would want to write about? I know you've been doing a lot of writing. It kind of trickles out and then comes out in streams over the years. But mm-hmm. What are you most interested in writing and sharing with the world right now?
I'm doing different things. I clearly can't say one thing in particular. Are you talking about halacha, hashkafa? What are you speaking about?
Whatever. I'm curious what's on your mind more than mine.
There are a number of tshuvas that I would like to put out. I've had tshuvas published.
Halachic responsa.
Halachic responsa, right. There's a two-volume work that was put out a few years ago called Oyach Mishpat, and I have a tshuva there on Havkas Kiddushin, which I think is a right.
On marriage annulment, which I assume you oppose to some degree.
A tshuva of mine came out a few months ago about using cards in hotels. Which I permit.
Oh, sure.
Oh, that might be of interest to people. I have an article of a festschrift for the former chief rabbi of England, Jonathan.
Sure, I've seen that article. Beautiful, on the formation of the Talmud.
But what would I like to do? Okay, there's different things. I think actually, if you look in, if you Google Chakira seminar. It was a seminar of Chakira magazine that was on. Was actually on the online. Zoom.
Yeah.
And there were certain people who give talks on the philosophy of Rabbi Soloveitchik, on the halachic mind, and I gave a 20-minute talk. I think that talk has to be expanded, and I think that will probably be the next article that I'm going to write. But
so let me ask you, you don't have to answer this question, but I'm too curious not to ask.
Yes.
You came from a background in Ivy Leagues. You studied mathematics, physics. At some point, you decided to immerse your life into Torah. What do you attribute that drew you to make such a serious change in the focus of your life and your very clearly gifted intellectual powers to dedicate it purely to Torah?
I loved it. That's right. I was zeichet to do what I like to do.
Is there a personality you would attribute who brought you to that love?
Well, I studied in Beis Shesa by Rabbi Yankov Yaffin, who knew Kala
Teva. Sure.
But I think that the Chazon Ish writes are, in addition to those who I happen to have known when they were, you know, by Rosh Hashiva, but I think that when a person learns the Torah of the Gedolim, the Chazon Ish, Shlomo Zalman, even Rabbi Yosef Ben Soloveitchik, these are our rabbis. These are people who give us Avos Torah. They inspire us. And it doesn't have to be a rabbi that you actually learn from. You could learn from his father. The Chazon Ish says the Shimish Tamil Chacham is learning through this father, the Paiskim. And I think that this is a place which is a source of both inspiration and simcha. And this is, I think, what propels me to continue what I'm doing.
Okay, final question. This is the most whimsical. I'm almost embarrassed to ask you, but I ask everybody. What time do you usually go to sleep and what time do you wake up in the morning?
Well, I daven vasikin.
Okay, so it's early.
So if you take about 45 minutes, an hour before Netzach Hamah, right, that's your
rising of the sun, yeah.
When I go to sleep, it depends. Sometimes I fall asleep early, sometimes I fall asleep. I don't have a rigid temporal schedule. If something keeps me awake, I stay awake.
And why am I not surprised with the energy of the way that you speak and your ideas? You don't seem like somebody who has that rigidity of schedule. And it's great that we get the gift of the excitement of your Torah. And that's a product of it.
Okay. Anyway, so that's everything in a nutshell.
Okay. It's such a privilege.
I'm exhausted right now, but anyway, that's another point. But that's a siyata d'shmaya that in the many years I give shiur, right, I was never taught, even though I've come into Baruch Shalom many times, very exhausted. Once the shiur begins, I feel energized.
Okay. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak. It really means a great deal. And it's such a privilege and pleasure to speak with you today, Rabbi Tribbetz. Leaving my conversation with Rabbi Tribbetz, I think the central question is really a question that's not about science and religion per se, but what is the Talmud? Like when we read through the Talmud and you come through passages that clearly, you know, don't have relevance, like how do you look at that and what does that tell you and how does that allow you to explore the larger question of what was done with the canonization of the Talmud? What is this body of knowledge, body of work representing for us? And I think it's one of the most exciting questions in all of Jewish thought. I've always been enamored with the chaos of the Gemara of the Talmud itself. And I think my conversation with him is really a almost radical new lens to appreciate the large body of work, the Talmud, that has sustained Jewish thought, ideas, and practice through the centuries. So thank you so much for listening. It wouldn't be a Jewish podcast without a little bit of schnarring. So if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and review. Tell your friends about it. It really helps us reach new listeners and continue putting out great content. If you'd like to learn more about this topic or some of the other great ones we've covered, be sure to check out 1840. That's the number 18, followed by the word 40, FORTY.org, 1840.org. You'll also find videos, articles, and recommended readings. Thank you so much for listening, and stay curious, my friends.